This is the second in a session, in a set of four sessions about the arts. We talked about architecture yesterday, and we're going to talk about drama and theater today. And on Thursday, I got a day off tomorrow, but on Thursday there'll be a discussion about words and language, and on Friday a session on signs, symbols, and signification, okay? Including vestments and color and stuff like that. So today we want to take a look at worship and drama. But I'd like to go back for a minute and review what we did yesterday, if I can find what I did yesterday here in my notes. Namely, talking about a kind of introductory word, so to speak, that all of the arts represent, like all of nature and all of life, represents a gift. I wanted to make that clear from the beginning. I talked about the philosophical idea of ontological necessity. Wonderful term. That asks the question, you see. Ontological means having to do with being, having to do with existence. And the question is this: why is anything that is necessary? Why is it necessary that there be anything in the world? You or me or the snowflakes that each are different? Or as I said, a field of wildflowers up in the alpine meadow that nobody sees? I mean, what's the point of it? You know, as Kemmerer would say, there's no, what's his word? Cost effectiveness. You know, I mean, God just does that. And when you begin to think in those terms, you see that everything is a gift. Everything is a gift. So that's first. Then I would like to point out, again, this is all introduction, as I pointed out yesterday, art is also a word, it's a language, it's a communication. All of these arts, architecture, the way you arrange the space, that preaches, that says something. If you were with me yesterday, we talked about radial and axial buildings, buildings that are based on gathering around a circle, or buildings that are based on walking in a journey. And they both preach different sermons, and they're legitimate sermons, either of them, both of them. But they're different sermons. And we ought to ask, what are the arts saying to us? What is the arts of architecture saying to us? What are the arts today of drama and action and movement saying to us? What are the arts of language and words saying and speaking? What is the language of music? We're not getting into that because there are other people in the village who talk about music. But we are going to get into signs and symbols and vestments and color. How do we speak through all of that? So art is a means of expressing and a means of communicating, all of these arts that we're talking about. Further, this is the third point in my introduction still, art represents a kind of incarnation. We have an incarnational faith, that is God coming in the flesh in the baby in Nazareth. But as Luther would want to point out, God comes in the flesh, so to speak, of the water of baptism. God comes in the flesh, again, you might say, in the bread and the cup of communion. God comes in the flesh, again, of a preacher with all the preacher's strange idiosyncrasies and warts and weaknesses. And God comes in the flesh of a Christian friend. We have, in other words, an incarnational faith. We have a faith that worries about the stuff. This stuff. It worries about the molecules. And the whole point of communion, for instance, is that God wants to meet you at the level of the molecules. When you eat and drink and actually digest and actually metabolize, that's the level at which God wants to meet you. And that suggests to me that God ought to be concerned, and is indeed concerned, about the hole in the ozone layer and the destruction of the Amazon rainforest. You know why the Amazon rainforest is being destroyed. Are you ready for this? So to make pastures for?
Is it marijuana?
No, well, that may be some of it too, for opium and drugs. Yeah. That may be part of it. But chiefly, as I understand it, to make pasture for beef cattle for McDonald's and Hamburger King.
Oh, God.
Not just McDonald's, but Burger King and parties and all the others. I mean, that's bad news, and that, you know, that's a justice issue now, right? Anyhow, this is the whole point of the arts, that they mean to communicate, and they represent the incarnation for us, and we ought to take that stuff of the world very seriously. Those molecules are intended to be taken very seriously, including the molecules of the rainforest. And finally, this is all introduction, the arts as discipline. In other words, it's hard work to be an architect. It's hard work to be a dancer, or a mime, or an actor, or somebody who knows how to use voice and body, and so on. It's hard work to be somebody who makes a vestment. Have you ever sewn a pyramid or a banner? You know, that's hard work. And we should respect the hard work that the artist devotes to the art. And we shouldn't have, as it says in Jude, you can read this in the Bible, the first chapter of Jude, the 10th verse, the arrogance of ignorance. It says in that verse, they despise what they do not understand. You know, so we ought to be humble before a work of art, as I said yesterday, and be willing to be instructed, be willing to listen to the architect, or the dramatist, or the mime, or the dancer, or the vestment maker, or the poet, or the literary person, you know. Wasn't that wonderful last night? Were you part of that?
Oh, yes.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, that ought to teach us something, right? I mean, we ought to sit there and soak all that stuff up. Okay, that's all a review of the introduction, that is the introduction to all of these sessions. Let us move to Christian worship as drama. Christian worship as theater. I don't think we have to apologize for the fact that there is a kind of dramatic or theatrical aspect to all of our worship. And as a matter of fact, I would even argue that worship is chiefly something that people do. It's not so much something that people say as something that people do. And I think Protestants and Lutherans too have this notion that worship is chiefly words. Words that you sing, words that you pray, words that you read out of a Bible, words that the preacher preaches. Sure, words are a very important part of it, and we'll get to that on Thursday. But Jesus in the upper room says, do this in remembrance of me. So worship is what people do. And I think there's a kind of a heresy abroad that I would call word reductionism. That means it wants to reduce everything to words. Now, words are important. Again, I don't want to deny that. But there is a kind of a word reductionism, and may I say, in all charity, last night's Vespers was a sample of it, that wants to say, well, it's words that are important here and the actions are not. Vespers, the way the Vespers was set up that we sang, and the way you can find Vespers in the Green Book, that's a great dramatic service, and maybe we can get to do that before the week is out. You're supposed to bring in a big candle. You don't have to, but it's kind of nice. You bring in this big candle. The Jews, you know, every night would think of the beginning of the day as being sundown of the previous day. Are you familiar with that? That's why Christmas Eve is part of Christmas. It's not part of Advent. That's why Easter Eve is part of Easter and not part of Lent. Anyhow, the Jews would think of the day as beginning with the previous sundown, and they would light a candle. Did you ever see Fiddler on the Roof, the movie or the play where Goldie lights the Sabbath lights and has this wonderful little song about the coming of the... And the light of the candle of the Vespers of the night before is an anticipation of the daylight. It's going to come 8 hours later or 9 hours later or whenever. So, last night, for instance, they could have borne in this single candle, everything else in darkness, light other lights from that candle. I mean, a wonderful picture. And everybody has a hand candle, maybe. And you sing praise to God, the candle representing both God and the light of Christ. And the readings, again, all that, you know, those kids, they didn't know any better. I mean, I'm not blaming them, but they kind of stood in a row there like the Andrews sisters or something, and they spoke and sung. But it might have been done with a little more drama, not just for the sake of drama, but to make it clear as to what was going on. The service of light with the candle, then a service of readings, and then the prayers and hymns and so on. Anyhow, I have a teacher who says that the rubrics in the book are as important as the words. You know what rubrics are? Rubrics, that's a word from the Latin. Rubor in Latin means red. And rubrics are these little red directions here in the book. And they're directions, they don't happen to be printed in red in the other volume. But those are rubrics. And, says one of my teachers, if we have the rubrics right, and if we understand what we're supposed to be doing, the words will be there. You wouldn't even need a book. Mm-hmm. And I think he's right. Because the rubrics are, you might say, the stage directions for a drama. And the words then are the text of the drama. And if we understood what the rubrics meant to say, you know, the words would be there. We have the text. So, I think that's a helpful warning. We're going to say a few words when we get to the end of our session today about entertainment evangelism and performance. But let me just say this right now. Soren Kierkegaard has pointed out how in worship we have, through most of our life and in much of our architecture, been given the wrong impression. We talked about this yesterday, those of you who were with me in the architecture session. It's as if there's, in some churches, a kind of a two-room space. And this space is for the people. And this space here is for the clergy. And here's the altar. And there's a kind of a two-room space, in other words. And you see it over here in the village center, where there's a stage and an audience, so to speak. And tonight, I think there's going to be a mime presentation, and she's going to use the stage, and we're going to have chairs set up in rows. You look at the back of another person's head, and you watch a performer. Now, a lot of people think that's what worship is. You're an audience, and you're watching people perform, and the people who are performing are the pastor, and the preacher, and the musician, and the choir, and, you know, the acolytes and so on. They're the performers who are putting on a show for the people in the pew. And it's as if, according to this analogy, God is in the prompter's box over here, just off stage, whispering the cues, you know, to the performers. Now, that's the wrong picture of worship, says Kierkegaard. You know Soren Kierkegaard, wonderful philosopher and Lutheran theologian. Anyhow, he says the right picture is this. We are all invited to be actors on stage. Everybody in the congregation is a performer, an actor in this drama. Now, you may not want to be. You may want to come in and sneak and sit in the back pew, like a lot of Lutherans. So you may not want to be invited up on stage, but you should be invited. There should be a sense that everybody who comes in the door is invited to be an actor on stage. So we're not going to have a two-room space anymore. We're just going to have a one-room space. Maybe we even want to change the way that the seats are arranged. And they've done that over here, you see, for most of our worship. Isn't that so? And Paul Olson did that last night to make his production more of a, you know, participatory thing. We have the altar here, and the people gathered around like that. And it's the people's voice of praise that is the important voice. And the pastor and the preacher and the worship leaders and the musician and the choir and so on, they're in the prompter's box whispering the cues to the people. And who is in the audience?
God.
Right. Very good. Now that's the right analogy, says Kierkegaard. We are all performers on stage. We're all invited to be performers on stage. You may not want to take up your role, but you're invited to be. And if you want to, you can sit in the back. You can even sit in the back here, you see, or here. And you can refuse to be a part of it. But ideally, you should be at least invited to be one of the performers. And your voice of praise is the most important voice. Did you want to make a comment? Feel free to interrupt me along the way. Okay, let's move along.
I guess I'll make.
Go ahead. Well, I'm going to, but I'm very much into that sort of feeling that, you know, liturgy as the work of the people.
Sure, that's exactly what the word liturgy means, the work of the people. Greek word.
But at the same time, there, I think we have to have a respect for a number of different ways of worship. People really do choose different ways to be, and there are different settings of worship which do different things depending on what we are doing. There are times when perhaps it conveys a different message when we have worship in a different style, when there is more of a separation. It's not the way a common worship would go, but we have to respect that there are some differences in there, and people approach all of that and from different perspectives and in different ways, and it's helpful to be able to appreciate all of those ways and not feel like every time you go to church, well, I have to figure out whether I want to be on stage.
And yeah. And I hear an extension of your argument. This may not be exactly what you were thinking of, but I'm thinking of it. For instance, the choir anthem. You know, there's a sense in which they're performing now on your behalf. They're praising God, let us hope. But there's a sense in which you're kind of an audience there listening to the choir anthem, and that's okay. Same with the prelude and the postlude. You know, I would grant the validity of your argument. And we're going to get into the point here in a minute that the whole experience, you see, is a kind of a drama. It's kind of a theatrical thing. And the people who are the worship leaders, the cheerleaders, if you want to call them that, or the prompters, they should know something about theater, and they should know something about performing. And we're gonna come to that in just a minute, that the people should know how to project their voice and so on. Paul could do that yesterday in the evening, you know, with his plays and so on, and he didn't need any mic, any microphone. I hate those microphones over there. I think they're terrible. I made a speech about this yesterday. I think church ought to be low-tech. I think Christian worship ought to be low-tech, not high-tech, low-tech. Primary experience. People are hungry, I think, for primary experience. Real flowers on the altar, not plastic. A real candle flame, not electric, where you, have you seen the ones they even flicker now? You can get an electric bulb, you know, that you put in the electric and it flickers. That's kind of phony. Again, God doesn't care a great deal, as long as there's a sincere heart. But people care. I think we want to feed people with the best that we can give them. Okay, Christian worship as theater, again, what I would call the ritual contract. When people walk in the door, they should have this sense of contract of being invited to be on stage. And as I say, they may not want to be, they may want to sit and just look or listen, and we ought to grant that. We shouldn't coerce anybody. But at its best, Christian worship is participatory. And may I say that even last night, when Paul Olson did his poems, that was still very participatory, wasn't it? I mean, we were with him, weren't we? And he was saying the words, but oh boy, I had tears in my eyes when he was King Lear with his dead daughter. Oh dear, that really broke me up. You may have been broken up at other moments too. I mean, that was wonderful. And that kind of performance at its best is also participatory. And something, I think it has something to do with the way he arranged that space. You know, we were all sitting kind of around him. He was right in our middle, you know, right in the middle of us. He wasn't up on a stage far away. Okay, so the worship leaders and the people who plan worship, you see, are, as I have said last week, producers and directors and actors in a kind of a theatrical event that is very exciting to me. I mean, I love the theater, as you probably have guessed already, and I love the thought that every Sunday, I've got to be the producer and the director and one of the chief actors, and the people are other actors, and the choir and the organist and so on, they're other actors too. But I'm one of the people that has to pull all that together and make that work. And I want to tell you, I was in charge of, were some of you here on Sunday night? Mm-hmm. Not all of you, but some of you were. On Sunday night, you know, that service when I presided, I worked like a dog. I worked all weekend, you know, getting that service ready. And Eric and I, he was the musician, he and I had to decide what music we were going to use, what hymns we were going to sing, what the choir was going to do. I had to work with Phyllis because we had liturgical dance in the service.
Phyllis and Brian, and we had to negotiate, well, the pulpit is going to get in the way. Well, you don't really need the pulpit. He can preach from the altar. You know, it's that kind of thing. And where are we going to put the altar? And what about those mics? They're going to get in the way. And, you know, oh, my Lord, really, all weekend I was working to make that service a good service. And I think it was a good service. And I think God was pleased. And more importantly, even, I think people were fed by it. So that's kind of exciting to me. And Christian worship, therefore, is a complex of roles and ministries. There's a ministry of the people in the pew. There's a ministry of the preacher. There's a ministry of the presider, the person who's up at the altar. There's a ministry of the musician, the choir, and the organist, and the choir director. There's a ministry of the lectors. There's a ministry of the acolyte. There's a ministry of the greeters and the ushers. You know, they all have an important ministry, and worship is a complex of all of those. Okay, are you ready to play around a little bit? Let me suggest you get on your feet for a minute. This is the way the Jews, we're going to talk about three things now. I should introduce this. We're going to talk about three things. We're going to talk about posture, position, and gesture. And you can play around with me. Okay? First of all, posture. The Jews did not kneel to pray. They stood to pray. And they stood with their hands up. You can all go like this. Hands up and palm out, as if you're looking out from under the porch to see if it's raining. Because God is showering blessings on you. Beautiful. The charismatics, right? The Pentecostals do this all the time. It's really very lovely. But it's very Jewish. And the head is up and the eyes are open. That's called the Orans posture of prayer. Isn't that lovely? You don't want to be hands up, you know, like a crook is out of a gun on you. You don't want to be like that. But it's as if you're waiting for God to shower blessings on you. Now that was the Jewish method of praying. And Christians took it over. And for Christians, Jews first, but Christians later, it meant two things, as I was saying to you a minute ago. It meant, first of all, the image of God. You are made in the image of God, and you can be proud of that. And God honors you by making you in God's own image. So that's the first thing. You're modeling the fact that human beings are made in the image of God. The second thing you're modeling is resurrection. The term for Greek in resurrection is anastasia. There's another way. No. Anastasia. You've heard people, a woman's name? Anastasia. That's it. Anastasia. Stasia from stable, status, all those words are related. Anyhow, that means standing, and ana means standing again. So the word in Greek for resurrection is Christ standing again. The word in German is Auferstehung. Auferstehung, I think. Am I spelling that right? And the word in Danish is opstandelm, something like that. I may not be spelling that right, but all of them mean the standing up of Christ. Christ is not dead, he's not lying down, he's not lifeless, he's standing up. So, the resurrection posture is the posture of standing erect. And this is why a lot of people are saying you don't have to kneel at communion, you can stand up to receive communion. As a model of, first of all, the image of God, and second, the resurrection of Christ. Now, let's all kneel if you're able. If you got a bad knee, you can sit down. But let's just feel how different this is. If you got a bad knee, you can sit, sure. Now, this posture came into Christian use. I don't think it ever got popular among the Jews, but it came into Christian use in the 4th century AD after Christ, as I understand it, and it came from the battlefield, and it came from Syria. It wasn't Jewish, it was Syrian. And you kneel in front of your conqueror on the battlefield, and you do this with me. You held out your hands for the chains of slavery, and you bowed your head for, guess what? The axe, yeah, or the sword, you know. I mean, that is super humble, right? That is a super humble position. And it became popular 4th century, 5th, 6th, into the Middle Ages. And it's appropriate enough. If you want to sit down, you can sit down. But it feels different, doesn't it, than standing up? Standing in the image of God and as an image of the resurrection, that's the Jewish way of prayer. And this kind of prayer, again, there's nothing wrong with it. There might be times when you feel kind of humble, right? What would be a posture that is more humble than this?
Lying flat on
the
stomach.
Lying flat, yeah, prostrate, actually prostrate. And if you've ever seen pictures of a Roman Catholic ordination, yeah, the priests there are actually right on the floor like this. That is really humble. Okay, this is almost as humble. And I would argue, as a worship leader, that I would say, let's kneel, for instance, like this, in Advent maybe, or Lent, which have a kind of a penitential flavor. You know what I mean? But at other times, I think I want to stand in worship. Now, that's a matter of posture. In any case, worship leaders and people in the pew, too, want to stand up nice and straight because they are in the image of God and because they are a picture of the resurrection, not just on Sunday morning, but the rest of the week, too. And I teach seminarians. My job back home is to be a teacher at a seminary, and I teach people who want to be pastors, both sexes, male and female. And a lot of times when they lead worship, I give a kind of a critique afterward. We have daily worship, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, just like here. And I give a critique at the end of the week. And I said, you know, on Thursday, when you were leading morning prayer or whatever, can I model for you what I saw? And they'll usually say, sure. And I'll say, this is what I saw. Oh, Lord, open our lips. You know, they were all kind of slouched over. And I said, boy, that's not a very good picture of the image of God or of the resurrection. So I tell him to stand up. I mean, you shouldn't look like a soldier, you know, I'm not saying that. But you want to take delight in yourself the way God takes delight in you, and you want to image the resurrection, and you want to image the image of God and the resurrection of Christ. So I tell people they should stand up and walk nice and straight, not just on Sunday morning in worship, but the rest of the week too. I got a dear friend who's a wonderful preacher and a wonderful presider, but he just stands with a slouch. And he leads worship that way. And the rest of the week when he walks around, you know, with his family and his job, you know, he slouches then too. And I think that's such a pity because he's a handsome fellow and he doesn't have any ailments, you know, he should stand up. That's neat. Okay, so much for posture. Auferstehung and Anastasia and Upstalden, they're good words to remember. They're probably the same in other languages, too. I don't know all the other languages so well. How are we doing here? So much for posture. Let's think in terms of position. Where would you stand if you were... You thought something funny?
Oh, I'm sorry.
You can share.
Mary has three children, and the third one is named Anna, and she kind of, they kind of came in quick succession there. So I said, well, Anna means again.
Oh, very good. That's cute. That's cute. Okay, if you were going to preach in a church, where would, now we're talking position here. We just checked off this. Now we're going down here. Where would you stand if you were going to preach?
Where most people could see you.
Where people can see you. Good point. Now, Scott, on Sunday, preached at the altar. And that, there's a long history of that. That's quite legit. But it's kind of nice to have a pulpit, too, or a lectern. Go ahead.
About where people can hear you.
And people, yeah, where people can both see you and hear you. Very good. Very good. So, over the years, a lectern has developed, or a pulpit, sometimes raised up. So, again, if it's a big crowd, people don't have to peer over the top of heads and so on. You know, that's quite legit. If you were going to preach, I think I'd want to stand in a place where people could both see and hear. How about if you were going to baptize? You'd want to go to another place. Where would that be? The font, right? Wherever the font is. Gather the people there. If you were going to preside at the communion with the bread and the cup, you'd need an altar to put the bread and the cup on, right? And you need a stand by it. And these days, you see freestanding altar, we talked about this yesterday when we were into architecture, a freestanding altar where the priest or the presiding minister can stand facing the people, across the table. It's like the family of God gathered around. It's a lovely picture. In the old days, remember, when I was a kid, my dad was a pastor, and even into my seminary years and beyond, the altar was up against the wall, right? Oh. And the priest or the minister always had the back to you, right? Mm-hmm. Now, that all developed in the Middle Ages with this two-room space that I was referring to. But the earliest churches, the altar was always freestanding. And as I said yesterday, the Presbyterians have always had the elders standing behind the table, and the primitive church always did it, and the Pope in Rome, in St. Peter's, always stands facing the people. So as I said, when you have a freestanding altar, it is primitive and Presbyterian and papal. And you can't say that about everything in Christian history. But anyhow, that's a good thing, I think, that we're pulling the altar out from the wall. And if your church does not have an altar that's pulled out from the wall, I would work to get it happen, work to make it happen. It may be difficult, but not just in terms of architecture, but in terms of the people and their resistance to it. But it's a wonderful picture. So you have basically the four locations that I talked about yesterday and that we've just suggested here. Altar for the meal, that is Holy Communion. You have font for baptism. You have, I'm going to call it ambo, because it's one word that means both pulpit and lectern. That's for the word, for preaching or reading. And then this word you maybe didn't know, and I brought it up yesterday, sedalia is the seat of the presider. And as I said yesterday, in some of the ancient churches, the seat of the presider was the most important piece of furniture, more important than the altar even, because the presider represents Jesus too. The altar represents Jesus, but so does the presider, and so do the people. As a matter of fact, you ought to remember this, the term Holy Communion is a corporate noun. We are the Holy Communion. The Holy Communion is the bread and the wine, sure, but Jesus says, this is my body. And I'll bet he means not just the bread, but you people. You are the body of Christ. Nice, huh? And the Holy Communion is us, first and foremost. The Holy Communion is us. And anyhow, the seat of the presider, this is where I would lead worship if it were me. I would lead worship from the seat. Sedalia is Latin for seat. And I would go to the ambo, the pulpit or the lectern, when I read the scriptures and when I preached from the scriptures. And I would go to the font at baptism, and I would go to the altar for the meal. And I would even try to keep those separate. In other words, I probably would not go to the altar to preach normally. I mean, we're the church of the Word of God, and we don't have to apologize for that. So I think the pulpit ought to be, a pulpit, lectern, ambo, whatever, ought to be an important piece of furniture in a building.
Was the pulpit always in the right and the...
Well, yes, there's a reason for that. Did I mention that yesterday? I should have. Again, in a church building, a lot of church buildings from the air are cruciform. They're in the shape of a cross. And the altar might be here, or in old buildings that they're remodeling, they're building a platform here and putting the altar here, and that's kind of neat. But the pulpit has always, almost always been in the north side. This is east, facing the whole church, facing the sun, the rising sun, nice symbol. Therefore, this would be north, right? And again, think in terms of a Mediterranean land. That's where the faith began, in Israel, Mediterranean land. The pagans were all in the north, the barbarians.
Oh.
Us, Germans and Scandinavians, Vikings and Celts and Druids and so on. Okay, the Mediterranean faith of the early centuries, you know, 1st, 2nd, 3rd century and so on, they saw the north as being the place of the pagans, and so they put the pulpit in the north to proclaim the gospel to the north. I mean, it's kind of a little bit of liturgical trivia.
Now, it doesn't matter a bit. If your church works better with the pulpit in the south, that's okay too. But I kind of like the notion that it's in the north to preach to the heathen, including your grandfather and mine, your grandmother and mine. Okay. That's liturgical trivia, but it's kind of fun, isn't it, to know that? And if I were building a church and I had the choice, you know, I think I would try to orient the church toward the east, and I think I would try to have the pulpit in the north, just to honor that old tradition. Okay, moving along. What's that?
It reminds me of this phrase, I saw the enemy, and it was us.
And it was us, yeah.
We're the north.
You surely are.
We sure are.
Okay. Posture, position, again. I would save the altar for the meal. More than that, I would save the altar for the moment of the meal. In other words, I wouldn't use the altar at all for morning prayer or evening prayer or any of those other services. Save the altar just for Holy Communion. And I would even save the altar for the moment of Holy Communion. Namely, I wouldn't go there until the offertory, until you brought the money and the bread and the wine forward for the communion, then I would go to the altar. But the service I would lead from the seat, lead worship from the seat, read the scriptures from the pulpit or lectern, and I think just one, you don't need both a pulpit and a lectern, I would have just one place of the word, and go to the altar then at the offering. I think when you do that, you see, you are honoring those spaces, and you're teaching the people, this is what's important. And if the font, for instance, is in the west end of the church, as it frequently is, this would be west, right? Entrance to the Christian life, entrance to the Christian liturgy, right through baptism. And as I said yesterday, you can find churches in Europe, and some in this country too, where the baptismal font is right in the entrance, narthex. Walk past it to get into the building. It's a picture of baptism first, then you're a Christian and you begin your Christian life.
We don't put flowers on our altar anymore. We kept them separate. Is there a reason for that?
No good reason. Strictly aesthetic, I think. Wherever it looks best. I've seen a lot of chancels and a lot of altars that are awfully cluttered. And I think most churches could be improved by just taking all the clutter away and having just the altar there. Put the flowers somewhere else, maybe at the foot of the altar. You know, down here in the foot of the pulpit, or in the front of the altar here. Or I've seen chancels where there's a nice big altar and the flower pot, just one lovely flower pot is standing over here, great big flower arrangement, and the pulpit is here in the north. You know, that's kind of pretty. Again, it doesn't have to be symmetrical. Richard Kemmerer, any of you know this wild man? Richard Kemmerer, funny, funny guy. And he talks about architecture where everything is symmetrical. You know, two candles, bing, bing. Two flower vases, bing, bing. Two lecterns and pulpits, bing, bing. You know, he says, that's church designed by Rorschach. You know, it's like plotting one side. I mean, crazy. It doesn't have to be symmetrical.
You've been to our church.
Isn't he a wild?
I've pointed that out, and we still can't get away from it.
He's wonderful, yeah.
But thinking of it, you know, we have to have two plants the same, and one doesn't grow the same. Yeah. One is way bigger, one is
right.
But you can't change
it. Ridiculous. No, it doesn't have to be symmetrical.
It was about the flowers. I was reading something that was trying to get people to clear the altar and make it just a simple table for a meal.
Sure.
The idea that your dining table wouldn't be cluttered with all these things.
Yeah.
But flowers is something I would put on my dining table.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. I think they're quite appropriate.
When, you know, that just kind of hit me that, uh-huh. that this idea was to clear it and you wouldn't put flowers on the table. But I would.
Yeah, sure. And there's something to be said for flowers on the table of the Lord, too. I think I would want to give chief prominence to the bread and the cup. At the time of the meal, particularly. And I wouldn't want a missal stand, therefore, or a stand for the book that was big and imposing, and the cup and the plate, and, you know, where the bread is very small. That's the way we have it back where I am. We got a great, big, huge, I think it's even sterling silver missal stand that's absolutely gorgeous. And then the best we can do for the cup and the bread and the wine is pewter, you know, and it's smaller. So right away, your attention is drawn to this great, big book stand.
One of the other comments, though, about why flowers have probably gone off altars is with a freestanding altar and the presiders.
It does clutter.
Flowers can kind of drown the person.
Exactly, exactly. So you have to make those discriminations. There, a lot of them are judgment calls, you know, like a judgment call in baseball. Is he safe or is he out? Well, you almost have to see a video. 60-40, you know, a lot of your choices are of that nature. But you want to keep the space uncluttered. And if I one of my favorite hobbies is going into other churches and saying how I would change it, improve it. And I like to think improve. You know, one of the things you can do to improve is to unclutter. Because things have a way of accreting. You know what I mean by that? You go into a brand new church building that the architect has just finished, and the designers and the builders have just finished, and it's beautiful and simple, and you know, nothing's there that doesn't need to be there. 5 years later, they've added, oh my Lord, a book stand and flower stands and credence tables, and oh my Lord. You know what I mean? It's just cluttered up with stuff.
People give
memorial. Oh, memorial, yeah. Yes, we'll talk more about this on Friday when we get into symbols.
Do you have any thoughts on presentation of the gifts, and we wind up there with the cup and, you know, like the bread and the wine.
Definitely.
And then we have the plate of money.
Yeah.
Is there a thought that there might be a different place for those particular gifts of money to go rather than on the altar? I mean,
yeah, the money represents our contemporary version of the kind of offering that they gave back in the primitive church. And in the primitive church, they would have given gifts of food, most likely, which would then be distributed to the widows and the poor after the service was over. Nowadays, we got money to do that, and I think that's a legitimate gesture, liturgical gesture. In fact, I have a friend who says that when you dig in your pocket and pull out your wallet or you write your envelope or whatever it is and put that in the plate, you know, that's even a North American gift to liturgy, because of course in the old state churches in Europe, it all comes out of the taxes. I mean, it's a terrible system there. So our system, I think, in North America is better. And I would treat the plates or the baskets or whatever they are with money the very same way that I would treat the bread and the wine. With no more respect, but no less respect either. In other words, I think they can belong on the altar. Now, in some churches, you present the offering plates on the altar and the bread and the wine on the altar. The bread and the wine stay there, and somebody takes the offering plates and puts them on a little credence table. Mm-hmm. Now, that's okay too. But I have no objection to the offering plates staying on the altar because they represent what the bread and the wine represents, namely our life. The bread and the wine are supposed to represent our life offered to God. And curiously and significantly, we're going to get to this when we talk on Friday, but significantly, it's not just grapes and grains of wheat, but it's bread that has been made out of grains of wheat. In other words, it's not God's natural element, but it's God's natural element, the wheat, that human beings have ground into flour and baked into bread, right? Same with the wine. It's not just the natural grapes. It's the grapes that human beings have made into wine, which can get people drunk even. We're going to talk about this on Friday too, that it's very important that it be wine and not Gatorade or grape juice. We'll talk more about that on Friday. But it's very important that it be both bread and wine that we have worked on and that we have corrupted, you might even say. Luther points out that the wine is the same wine that can get you drunk in the saloon. And the bread is the same bread that has dirt in it from under the fingernails of the baker. Luther was very earthy. but I like that. You know, this is the world that we've screwed up, God. And the money is, Lord knows where that money has been. You know, and what human beings have been bought and sold with that money. You know, I mean, that money is pretty dirty. But so is the bread and so is the wine. And we say, look, God, this is a symbol of our whole life. You've given it to us and we've screwed it up. We've loused it up in one way or another. Now, we put it on God's table. We bless God. We thank God for it. And God uses it to feed us. Or to feed the hungry in the case of the money. So, in answer, it's a long answer to your question, but I would be as respectful of the money as I am of the bread and the cup, but no more respectful. You know, some people hold up the money plates, you know, and they wouldn't think of doing that with the bread and the cup. If you're going to hold up the money, I'd hold up the bread and the cup too. because that's all one action in my view. Go ahead.
Now, I don't know if this is the place for this comment or not, but Dee and I assisted on Sunday night with the ministry of the communion. And we're part of a large congregation, and we have a sizable group of people who catch this duty about every third week or so in our church.
Who do what? Who?
We have communion, we administer communion in our church about every 3 or 4 weeks, the lay people.
Ah, oh, wonderful. Out to the people who are sick.
Oh, no. The whole congregation. The
whole congregation. We commune each Sunday.
Wonderful.
Each Sunday. And we have 10 at each service that assist.
Terrific.
By stations.
Excellent.
By stations.
So anyway, and I know I speak for both Dee and I when I say, even though we've been doing this for several years, we still look upon it as a real emotional experience.
Extremely.
Terrific, it should be.
And
that's holy stuff.
It's communication. Yeah. Yeah.
And we talked about this after Vespers on Sunday night, Dee and I, and we said, you know, it's funny that we see it in our own associates, in our church, and sometimes even with a pastor, they seem to get rather lackadaisical.
Casual, maybe, too. Yeah.
Casual.
And mumbly.
Yeah.
And to your credit, and you and Scott both, you made a point of telling the people who were going to assist on Sunday night
to look at
to look them in the eye.
Look them in the eye, sure, exactly.
Definitely.
That's a wonderful
and
moment.
Say,
yeah.
This is
for you.
This is the body of Christ.
Yeah, yeah. Wonderful.
You. Or this is the blood of Christ shed for you.
For you.
That's right.
But we hear a lot of mumbling and looking down.
Oh, yeah, terrible, terrible.
And to take it one step further, even for those who are giving a little blessing, for those who are not yet physically taking communion.
Sure.
I see them mumbling, and
yeah, no good.
Maybe many of those young people don't understand or could care less anyway, but they could just as well speak distinctly and to them and look at them when they're giving those. That
part of it, I think, is training, don't you? We just have to train people to do that. I mean, I'm endorsing exactly what you say. You are absolutely right. And last night we had another example of it, didn't we?
Right.
Three or four of those speakers had real nice voices and spoke nice and loud. But one kid came up there and he kind of mumbled at the microphone. And I couldn't even hear him, and I was sitting in the front row.
Right.
You know, he just hadn't been trained. And we have to train these people to speak nice and loudly, to look you in the face, even hold out your hand as if you're going to take the bread. I would use two hands. I would train my people to put, they used to say, you put one hand in the other to make a throne for the bread. You know, that's love. Now, when I do that, I look you in the eye and I touch you with my hand.
Always touch.
You know?
Oh.
I mean, that's so important. You know, that little touch and that little exchange between the eyes and speaking to them. I mean, that's very important. And if we train our people to do that, it makes such a difference.
And I like to be named.
Yeah.
What's that?
I like to be named.
Even the name, right? Yeah, Margaret, for you.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
And sometimes they don't know all.
Sure, yeah, maybe you should have a name tag.
Yeah, that's
nice. Oh, that's wonderful.
Awesome.
While we're talking about the community, I want to quit and invite some general conversations, but let me just say, regarding Sunday night, if Holden Village's worst enemy had designed a system of communion, it wouldn't be as bad as what they have here. I mean, that is a terrible system, I think. With all these different cups and all those little individual glasses and all, that just defeats the whole purpose, in my view, of what communion is.
It stops the full.
Yes, yes, and it's anti, it's against a sense of community.
So what would you do?
This individual thing, you know, it's me and Jesus.
Intinction you would do? You would do intinction or you would do common cup?
Well, I would have a common cup excuse. If I could pass a magic wand and change everything, I would have only the common cup, and it would be just wine.
Well, it always was that until 2 years ago.
Yeah, I don't know why they made that change.
Well, I'm sure it's because of a lot of concern about AIDS. And
you can't get AIDS from a common cup.
Well, you can't. Well, yeah.
But people who have AIDS can get a cold from a common cup if you have a cold.
Yeah, I was going to say,
the other way.
Yeah. Now, there's ways to solve that problem, and let me explain that a couple of ways. There is the so-called doctrine of concomitance. You ought to go home and tell your pastor this. Have you ever heard this word before? The doctrine of concomitance. It's a big word, but you've been learning big words all week, right? I think it's two on. Concomitance. The doctrine of concomitance says that the bread and the wine inhere in each other. In other words, if you got just the bread alone, it would be just as if
you got both bread and wine. And if you got just the wine alone, it would be as if you got both bread and wine. So it's always legitimate to take communion just with the bread alone or just with the wine alone. If you have an alcoholic, for instance, or if there's somebody who's got a bad cold, let them be encouraged to take just the bread and go back to their seat. Don't take the cup. If you are allergic to bread, you know, some people are allergic to the yeast or the gluten in bread, they can take the cup alone and go back to their seat. That's the method that I would recommend. Rather than, oh, did you see that tray full of glasses that that poor kid had to carry before the service began, you know, 20 minutes before he's staggering over with his tray full, and they're nice little cups and somebody's worked like a dog to make them, but I just think it's a terrible system.
What about intention?
Intention, sure, there's nothing wrong with that. You take the bread and you dip it in the cup. But some people are even scrupulous about that. I'm going to get somebody else's spit.
But there are, you know, there really have been some scientific studies that there are germs, and I'm pretty hardy strong person, I'm not too worried about it, but I mean, I do think there are some valid medical concerns about that.
Well, in that case, again, I would argue for taking the bread alone and not the cup. But I think the common cup and the common loaf, too, the wafers are just as bad, in my view. The wafers are just as bad as those little individual cups. Because they're individual. You see, it's you know the word oxymoron?
Yeah.
A contradiction in terms.
Yeah.
Either it's individual or it's communion. You know, either it's individual or it's common. And an individual communion wafer or an individual communion cup is just a contradiction.
We had a bad batch of wafers in our church one time, and they were getting mealy and a little worry.
Oh, dear. Awful.
I remember.
Well, wafers developed, you see, again, most of the terrible things that we're dealing with these days have developed from the Middle Ages. And in the Middle Ages, they had nuns, you know, who were making these wafers, which have the virtue of being very easy to handle, and they store pretty well normally. You know, you can keep them for months and months and months, normally. But it's convenience and efficiency and even sanitation are not the chief things that we talk about when we're talking about these signs, and we'll get to that on Friday. What does the sign itself say? That's what we have to ask ourselves. What is the message that we're given with those individual wafers or with those individual glasses as over against the message that we're giving with a common loaf and a common cup?
Togetherness.
You see, it's a different message, and we ought to ask what that is. Now, eventually we'll get to matters of sanitation. I agree with you. We have to get to the matter of sanitation sooner or later. But the first consideration ought to be, what is the sign itself trying to say?
I'm very much a fan of common cup and common loaf, and I would also choose that way over the rest.
Sure.
However, at some point we need to say part of the point of doing the worship is making people feel like worship and communion specifically are accessible to them.
Right.
If their concerns are so deeply founded that they will not drink from a common cup or they will not intinct.
Yeah.
Then you say, well, then just take the bread. Then all of a sudden, perhaps they'll feel like, well, they're being somewhat excluded from participating fully in communion if they do not get the idea of the doctrine of concomitants.
Yeah, that's a possibility.
It's getting to be a little bit. But, you know.
There's no free lunch. Every decision you make has has a price in some cases. You might point out that there was a tradition, well, long, long, hundreds of years among Roman Catholics of people just getting the bread. I mean, you know, Luther wanted the cup returned to the people. But for hundreds of years, a lot of Roman Catholics just had the bread.
And in fact, in daily mass, often...
It's just bread. I went to a mass one time where the Roman priest ran out of wine. There were more people than he expected. And they ran out of wine, and nobody thought anything of it. He just gave out the bread.
I was a Catholic, and a layperson was not allowed to touch the host.
Oh, yeah. Those days are over, pretty much. But again, you find individual priests who are...
Wine.
Yeah. And Cardinal Ratzinger, as I said yesterday, Cardinal Ratzinger wants to push the altar back against the wall.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Oh, dear. He's bad news.
I mean, he's a lovely man. He may be a lovely man, but...
He's walking backwards.
Yeah, right, right. I mean, he's taking us back to the Middle Ages. And, of course, the present Pope, he has his ear. I mean, the present Pope is a nice guy, too, but he's taken us back to the Middle Ages in a lot of areas. Have we got to quit? Almost. Something more?
We've got gestures.
You got gestures left. Yeah. Oh, gestures, yeah. Stand up. We'll do three gestures that are important.
Okay.
I taught you this one already. This is called orans. O-R-A-N-S. That's Latin, and it means praying. Do you know oremus? That means let us pray. Okay, orans is praying. That's the praying gesture. Isn't that lovely? Mm-hmm. All right, let's try out the hospitality gesture. The Lord be with you. Down here. Like you're welcoming somebody at the door of your house. You know, you open up the door, welcome. The Lord be with you. And what do you say?
And also with you.
Now, when I say the Lord be with you and hold out my hands, as somebody points out, I am speaking twice. I'm speaking with my words, and I'm speaking with this gesture. Isn't that lovely? Now, I could come up there and I could say, the Lord be with you. But it's not the same, is it? It's not as nice, I don't think, as the Lord be with you. And I've even seen this, and I've seen this recommended. I say, the Lord be with you, and you bow your head in acknowledgement. And then when you say, and also with you, I bow my head in acknowledgement. Hey, did you see Gandhi, the movie Gandhi? Gandhi comes up to Nehru and greets him with his hands together like this, and Nehru bows back. Oh, how lovely that we honor each other like this.
The whole Asian culture.
Yeah. Wonderful, yeah, we got something to learn. Don't you think?
Yeah.
We have something to learn from these people.
Yes.
And I have a friend who's a presider down in Pennsylvania, you know Gordon Lathrop, I think he's been to Holden Village. Anyhow, he says it's more important that you honor each other in the service than that you honor the altar. You know, Anglicans and some people, they come into the altar and they make a big bow to the altar.
Genuflect.
Well, that's okay. And when they leave, you know, they bow to the altar. But Gordon Lathrop, he bows to the people when he leaves. And when he enters, too. The Lord be with you, you bow. The Lord be with you, just a little bow. Beautiful. Now you say, and also with you.
And also with you.
Isn't that nice? Yeah. I think that's dynamite. Okay, this is praying, orans. This is hospitality. The Lord be with you, or any little moment like that where you're initiated. And then the blessing gesture, usually this is for pastors rather than lay people, but Almighty God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit bless you. And you should learn the sign of the cross too. Up, down, side to side. And you can trace it on yourself. Up, down, side to side. Doesn't matter whether it's left or right, right or left. The Greeks do it one way and the Romans do it the other way. Did you see Zorba the Greek? You ever see the movie Zorba? Oh, you ought to read it. It's wonderful. Because he's Greek Orthodox. And he crosses himself like this. But he has a Roman Catholic girlfriend, and she crosses herself this way. And he says, they do it wrong. And so it doesn't matter, left to right or right to left, and you come back to the middle. And that's a nice picture, you see. You are taking Jesus' cross to yourself. And you're putting it on. That's painful. The Orthodox go top, bottom, right, left, and then to the middle. But the Roman Catholics do top, bottom, left, right, and then. You see the difference?
Oh, okay.
It doesn't make any difference to God. But it's kind of nice. And when I go into the village center, I taught our kids this when we lived in Europe for a year. You go into those wonderful cathedrals, and there's this big water font right in the doorway. You dip your fingers in to remember your baptism. Nice. Martin Luther says you should do that. It's not magic. It's not superstitious. No. You're just remembering your baptism.
Remembering.
Every time you take a shower, you should remember your baptism. We got to get out of here. Hey, this is fun. We won't see you tomorrow, but I'll see you in 2 days for words. We'll talk about words.